Welcome to Think Why Radio. Think Why Radio is brought to you by the Wyoming Humanities Council, bringing people, programs, and ideas together that make you think. You can find us on thinkwhy.org. Today, we are talking to Andrew Palmer Todd, Executive Director of the Grand Teton Music Festival and an accomplished pianist. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Our focus today is to talk to you about your personal journey as an accomplished pianist and your philosophy and passion for music. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you'd like our audience to know?
Sure. The whole story? Or the cliff notes? I grew up in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in rural Midwest, central Ohio, which is a wonderful place to be from. Anybody who's been to Jackson Hole knows it's full of people who used to live in places like Indiana and Ohio and Minnesota. And we didn't have any musicians in the family. And I was very enamored with a very large pipe organ that we had at the church that we went to. So I kept pestering my parents, like, no, I'd be interested in doing that. And it was really just completely foreign to them, like, what I was asking for. And then there was actually a documentary on PBS about Vladimir Horowitz, who was a very well-known pianist in the 20th century. I said, I'd like to take piano lessons. I nagged him for a little longer. And then eventually we had a very accidental interface in the back of the Presbyterian Church in Marion, Ohio, with dear old Olive Joslin, who I thought must have been like ancient when we met her. And she was probably like 62, right? But you're 11 or 12. And she was an organist. She said, oh, yeah, I'm looking for piano students. And so I started taking lessons like the next week. My parents didn't buy a piano for the first year because they wanted to see if it would take, you know, good thrifty Midwesterners. And so every day after school, I would go with my mom to a different local church that my dad managed to get the key to. And I'd sit in there and I'd practice. And so that's sort of how I started. That was the beginning of it. And then very early on, the very nice thing about this woman, Olive, who was really terrific and a very worldly woman for Marion, Ohio, like she had the New York Times like on her coffee table, which we thought was a very exotic publication in Marion because like they had international news. It was crazy. She said, well, you know, you've progressed very quickly. I want to take you down to Ohio Wesleyan, which was a college south of us, and have you play for the teachers there. So after a year of studying with her, she passed me off to the organ teacher and piano teacher at Ohio Wesleyan, where I studied and took classes while I was in high school.
Wow.
So it was very fortunate, and it was just a great environment to be in.
So then you went from there to continue and study music.
Yes. And so most people who know this about me is I sort of had these dual interests, which were sports and music. So among other things that are part of the journey, which I'm passionate about, is sports and music are much more related than people think. You know, piano teachers and music teachers are always blaming sports for, you know, they take up all of my students' time and this and that. And of course, the world of the arts can be very confusing to a lot of athletes. But they're essentially the same thing. You're performing. You're doing something at a point in space and time in front of people. And no matter how much you practice or rehearse, it's all about what you're doing at that moment. So I was looking for a college where I could play soccer and have a good music education, went to Northwestern and started there and played soccer and studied piano. It was great to be in Chicago and go to concerts. It's not that I just didn't have access to that in Ohio mm-hmm. was growing up. I mean, if you went to the Columbus Symphony, you know, that was like a once a year thing. And at that time, and I think they still have it, Chicago Symphony had $10 student rush tickets, which was a fabulous program.
How large was the town you grew up in?
Oh, the Marion, Ohio was probably 20 to 25,000. And like by Wyoming standards, now that I say, I'm like, it was huge. But it felt way more rural than a place like Jackson Hole. you know, Jackson Hole or Aspen, where I lived before this, you know, people are attracted to those places, and it attracts the best and brightest of a variety of fields.
Mm-hmm.
Marion, Ohio just always felt it's a little backwater. And it was definitely like the Tri-County like magnet. Yeah, right. So like it was the big part. So that was Marion.
Did your parents support your desire to become a professional musician?
Oh, they supported everything. One of the great things about my parents, I have an older brother who was very gifted too, not a musician. And he was two grades ahead of me, and he went to Harvard, which also, like, when out of Marion, Ohio, that it was just like, what, you know, what's going on? That's like a mythical place out east. It's like Brigadoon. It like appears and then disappears. And whether it was me or my brother or soccer, which was viewed as like a vaguely communist activity in Marion at the time, they literally rolled with everything. To their credit, they just adopted a philosophy as parents, which is, these are your children. You just support what their interests are.
Oh, that's great.
That was just what they did. And, you know, so whether it's your older brother going to Harvard and trying to find the resources to pay for it, or the younger brother who's taking all of these music lessons, which aren't cheap, and they have been terrific about it. And to their credit, you know, my brother lives in Boston now and I live here, and they live in Charleston, South Carolina. You know, they've totally embraced the worlds that we live in, which are on the other side of the moon compared to where we grew up.
Right.
They were great. I think between my parents, they never missed any sports game that we played. So we always had one parent, you know, like if you're in the JV and varsity baseball or whatever, there was always a parent at every game and every performance. That's terrific.
Isn't that cool?
It's unconditional love.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
So you went on to graduate. What was your degree in?
Piano performance and U.S. history.
Oh, that's a good combination.
And then soccer. And then for those of people who are soccer fans, they all remember that the World Cup was in the U.S. in 1994, and it should be in 2022. Hate to get on my soapbox, but Qatar should not be hosting.
Okay.
Well, no, that's not coming up today. We'll get back to that.
Okay, we'll get back to that.
Anyways, 1994. So as a result of the World Cup in the U.S., there was a resurgence of professional soccer in the country. So I was literally in the right place at the right time. And there was a team in Chicago, and a buddy of mine who's the co-captain with me at Northwestern, we're like, let's just go try out. This would be great. This is like the best idea we have. And he had already gotten a job offer from McKinsey, with the large consulting firm in Chicago. And we showed up. There was probably like 200 people at tryouts. But this is also... this is just like being a musician. You go to competitions and you're like, the odds are long all the time. And you have to have this disbelief that like, oh, no, I totally belong here. And it's kind of like half self-delusion, you know, half kind of fake hubris. And you're like, but if you don't tell yourself you belong there, nobody else is going to believe that you belong there. So Dave Lynn and I, we would go to these tryouts, and we thought, this, well, you know, it's a long shot, but they need 23 players. We didn't know that 18 of the spots were like already like
selected
by people who'd actually, I don't know, played professional soccer before. And so we just kept going, and we didn't get cut, and we just kept going and going. Then they said, okay, here's the roster for a preseason trip to Puerto Rico. And our names were on there. And we're just like, okay. So I guess we're going to Puerto Rico next week for a week. And so that's sort of how that started. And that happened my last year at Northwestern. And Dave Lynn, though, I love the story, because he didn't have to, but he called McKinsey & Company, which is like no small thing, and say like, can I start maybe in September? And they let him, of all things. They thought, no, that's great. You just do that. We'll just show up after Labor Day. So I ended up playing professional soccer for a few years, which was great. And then the thing about sports is it's your entire career, but it's in a crucible. You know, it's not like, and this is how it's different than being an artist. I'm 42, and there's things I feel like are continually growing and you're exploring, and you have a sense that you can keep getting better for another couple decades. And most pianists and violinists, I mean, they're at their peak between like 58 and 72, depending on how their physical equipment, because they're physically all there, they're mentally all there, emotionally they're, you know, super well developed, and you've experienced life. Sports doesn't have that. I mean, it's not like at 42, I'm like, next year, my 100-yard dash is going to be faster than ever before. Not a chance.
Right.
So after 3 years of it, you're like, okay, this is going nowhere. And the big league in the U.S., the MLS, I kept showing up to tryouts for that and getting cut. And even I could see the writing on the wall. And so on a lark, I said, oh, there's this music festival in Aspen. That seems like a nice place to spend your summer. So I made an audition tape. So for those people who don't know, a tape is like, it's a cassette and you record onto it.
Just to remind people.
Right. It was the tail end of the 90s and it wasn't a mixtape. And I got into the music festival in Aspen, went and studied there for a couple summers, and then went on to Manus in New York, and then eventually a doctoral degree at CU.
When did you receive, I think you received a big national award as a pianist and your accomplished work?
Oh, the one that resulted in the Carnegie Hall concert. That was a competition in New York.
Okay.
This is where the sports and the music intersect, because there's just like 200 people from Curtis and Juilliard and Manus and Manhattan all there for the same thing. And you just keep going through these rounds, you know, round one, round two, round three, and... You know, and again, this was the 90s, so you got a phone call, you know, mm-hmm. when it happened. You didn't get an email, you know, or a text. And so it resulted in a Carnegie Hall debut concert, which was great and terrifying and great.
Well, I see you're relating sports, your study as a pianist, because both of those things take a lot of discipline. And like you
exactly.
said, if you're in that moment in time.
I mean, both, you know, the word that gets used so much now, which I think we all stole from yoga, is it's a practice. It's a discipline. It's a life. It's immersion. And there aren't things that you can say, I'm going to kind of do this three quarters. Right? I'm going to kind of wing it. The thing about some of these pursuits that are performance related, it's a brutal, honest world. And you'll be punished for that. I mean, you'll go up there and perform, and if you're three quarters prepared, it'll show. It just, once you're on stage, I mean, everything's exposed. You're in this heightened sense of awareness, and yeah. I talk about this with my son, who's 12, and says, well, I want to be a performer. And we talk a lot about liking the idea of being a performer and wanting to be a performer. The courage that it takes to walk across that stage door and look at those people and say, I think I have something that I want to invite you in, and I want to bring you in as part of this experience, is it's a responsibility.
Who inspired you? What was your inspiration?
For music?
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a long list. And I mean, it really starts, honestly, with that documentary that I watched, like sitting in that little living room on PBS and of Horowitz, because I didn't know that world existed.
Right.
And I think the other interesting thing about anything in the arts, whether you're a poet or a writer or a musician or a painter, is that it's this combination of it picks you and you pick it. But both of those things need to happen somewhere. And so you inside, you can be an artist, you could be a poet. But if the part where it doesn't interface with your life just doesn't happen, you may still have that soul at 40, but the practice of doing it and the study and the discipline of doing it might not have happened. So somewhere in it, you know, like you've got something that wants to come out, but then you're like, just on the little TV, you're like, oh, that's it. And you know it. It's like revealed truth. It's just right there. So that was probably the first inspiration. And even then, like, I know that now. I didn't know that at 11, right, when that was happening. But my piano teacher in high school, who has since passed away, she was a terrific inspiration because it's this just opening up a world. It's infinitely expansive. And I was telling my brother about this, about music. It's a little bit of a tangent. But when you go through major life transitions and you're an artist or you're a musician, it's the most grounding thing because I told him, I said, oh, you have to understand, Chris, who's my brother, that the only relationship I've had longer in my, almost as long as with mom and dad and you, is with music. And it's like, it's a living relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And you go through these life transitions, whatever they are, change of job, change of relationship, and you know, G major is still G major. So there's these like unshakable concrete truths to it, but it's also that Brahms violin sonata in G major that you're playing. The way you thought about it 10 years or 20 years ago is not the way you think about it today. So there's the part that's highly subjective and changing and how things relate. But every day that I sit and practice, I think about Mrs. Hopper, my piano teacher. There are things that are given to you and passed on, which are really remarkable. And it relates to my job, but I am very lucky to interface with 200 top-notch musicians every summer. And it's an embarrassment of riches, starting with Donald Runicles, our music director. And I have to say, spending as much time as I do with him and talking to him, it's completely changed how I approach music when I'm sitting down to learn it. Because here I am, you know, completely lucky in the other role of my life as an administrator that you just have these heady artistic talks. And one of my questions for him is that you're sitting down and he does these massive works and, you know, what's his rehearsal process for an orchestra and the way he approaches the structure and arc of a piece has been just a complete revelation to me. And so that also is an inspiration that gets put in your head. Mm. The other things, which isn't a surprise to anybody who lives in a beautiful place like this, is I love being outdoors. I'd like to think that I could flourish as an artist in a city, but I just think I'm still a country mouse and not a city kid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just necessary to be surrounded by beauty,
right?
For me. I've tried the other way and I just can't.
What's in the future for you, do you think, on your career as a pianist and maybe as the executive director for the music festival?
Every time you get that question, I always think of the Yogi Berra quote, which is the problem with the future is predicting it.
That is a problem.
Yeah. But as a pianist, part of it is not knowing and in enjoying that. What I'm really trying to do now on a practical level is get reestablished in an area where things are spread out. So with colleagues at University of Wyoming or maybe up in Bozeman or Pocatello, so that I have opportunities to perform and experiment with things and play with colleagues during the year. So that's on a practical level. The one current thing that I'm working on with solo literature is pairing American music that was written in the last 20 or 30 years with standard rap. And most recently, pairing Philip Glass with Mozart. They have all the same building blocks, two completely different approaches, and it's a fun project.
Are you going to be performing anytime soon around Jackson?
So, yes. So in my other world at the festival, I'll perform 4 or 5 times a summer. Every Tuesday we have something called Inside the Music. They're an hour long, they're free, and they're really informal talks about music and performing. So mine is Tuesday, July 7th, and it's Schumann in a Circle. So it deals with Schumann and Brahms and Mendelssohn, who represented one circle of influence early 19th century. Plus, there's the common thread of Clara Schumann, who was married to Robert, but Brahms was in love with. And Schumann was born 1810. She's 1819, and Brahms is 1833. So there's an age thing that's also fascinating.
Yes.
So some stories remain the same, regardless of the century.
So true.
So true.
So my final question is, how are you going to weave your personal passion and music philosophy into your work at the music festival?
Oh, at the festival? Oh, that's easy. The answer is easy. The application's not easy. I believe that great towns, cities deserve great arts. They just do. And the arts are a unique qualifier for places like Jackson Hole, Steamboat, Aspen, Santa Barbara. It's the natural splendor here is not to be duplicated anywhere else, except maybe the Alps. But what will make Jackson Hole a special community 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years? I mean, for decades and decades, to me is the arts. It's what the National Wildlife Museum does. It's what we do. It's what the Center for the Arts does. It's what Dancers Workshop will be doing. Because as those organizations and us continue to sort of bloom, it will put an imprint on this community that will last for decades. The philanthropy is here. The people have the interest here. It's a continually busy community. But I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
And I think people will want more, whether it's Think Why talks or TEDx-type talks. People come to these places to be renewed and refreshed. The arts and critical thinking and serious dialogue is part of that.
Right. Well, thank you for being here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it was very much a pleasure. Thanks so much, Andrew. Thank you for joining us. This is Think Why Radio, brought to you by the Wyoming Humanities Council, thinkwhy.org.